In a bitterly divided country, compromise has become a dirty word. Can the center hold? Well, one former resident of Capitol Hill says just maybe. We'll speak to him right now. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and make sure to get our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead, former Congressman and Florida Blue executive Jason Altmaier talks about the demise of Common Ground on Capitol Hill. Hear his insights. It's all in his new book, Dead Center. We're already getting calls for Jason. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's the 10th anniversary of the First Coast Pink Ribbon Symposium as Breast Cancer Awareness Month kicks off. Plus, we'll remember Gainesville native and rock legend Tom Petty here on the show. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, he's a former member of Congress calling for sanity in extreme and polarized times. Jason Altmaier served three terms in the U.S. House of Representatives from 2007 to 2013. He was that rare bird on the Hill, a bipartisan centrist. Yes, they do exist, known for working well with both sides of the aisle. Now, during his time in office, the nonpartisan National Journal calculated Altmaier's voting record to be at the exact midpoint of the House, the dead center, giving him the most centrist voting record in Congress. Not surprisingly, that's the title of his new book. In Dead Center, Jason Altmaier offers some solutions to the polarization that has paralyzed Washington and the nation. There's so much to discuss right now, everything from the deadly shooting spree in Las Vegas that has horrified us all, to our paralysis on what to do about health care, to the Russian investigation, and much, much more, as we welcome former Congressman and Florida Blue executive and author, the First Coast's own, Jason Altmaier, joining us in Studio 5. Jason, it's a pleasure, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm glad to be here.
And what are your questions for former Congressman and author of Dead Center, Jason Altmaier? What do you think needs to be done to bring the country together? The number to join us, 549-2937, that's 549-2937, or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also weigh in on Facebook. And it's sad that we bring you onto the show today when the country is still just so horrified about what we're learning in the wake of nearly 60 people killed in Las Vegas. You begin your book, in fact, talking about the Pulse shootings in Central Florida at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando.
I had been thinking about and kind of putting pen to paper for 2 years in writing this book. And then after the Pulse shooting, that really inspired me to move forward, because I think the message of what happened after the Pulse shooting, where you saw two sides of America, you saw the wonderful people who were responding in Orlando and across the country, raising money for the victims, donating blood, holding vigils, all the things that happened. That's the best in America. But the response on the political extreme, you also saw the worst of America. You saw people immediately, as we do now, unfortunately, after every national tragedy, we point fingers and cast blame and decide who's at fault and try to position for political advantage. And that's what happens in the political world. And it was that response in the following days that led me to the introduction of my book is actually about that topic.
Your book is called Dead Center because that's how you were ranked in Congress, the most centrist voting member of the Congress, which is unusual today.
Well, yeah, National Journal, during every session of Congress, they look at the people's voting records from the previous session on the major issues, and they rank everybody against each other. So out of 435 people, 217 were to my left and 217 were to my right. My voting record literally placed me in the middle.
What drew you to this centrist position? A Democrat, but a centrist moderate Democrat.
I ran the first time. I served three terms. When I ran the first time, I ran against somebody who was a partisan and pretty far to the extreme. And I talked my entire campaign about we need people in the middle who can compromise and negotiate and work together and get things done. And that makes you pretty popular in the general election. What you find out eventually is mm-hmm. that doesn't make you popular in the primary election because mm-hmm. your party, whether it be Democrat or Republican, your opponent is going to say, well, they work half the time with the other side. They're not really part of our team. They're part of the other team. And we need to get back to a Washington where people can have conversations and you're not punished for compromise, which unfortunately is the case today.
Is that why you left Congress? It just became too difficult to get elected, get reelected, because all the incentive is to be as partisan as possible.
Well, I had an interesting circumstance, which again leads me into the book, is my seat was eliminated in gerrymandering in Pennsylvania, where my seat was. We went from 19 congressional seats to 18, so that was part of it. And then I ran in a primary against another sitting member of Congress, somebody that we were colleagues working together. And because I had that centrist voting record, that was the criticism of me in the primary was, well, he's not really on our team. He's working with the other side. And that was viewed as a negative rather than a positive.
It didn't used to be that way. In the old days in Congress, not only did people work with the other side, they socialized with the other side. They lived in Washington, first of all. They didn't go home to their districts every weekend. They lived in Washington. They would go to each other's kids' sporting events. They'd go to dinner with each other, all that kind of stuff. That just doesn't happen today.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, one of my favorite parts of the book is I did some research on that. And there's an American University political science professor named Jennifer Lawless who looked into this and researched all the votes in Congress going back 40 years, talking about how people work together, who's co-sponsoring each other's bills, who's traveling together on these overseas trips. And it's a misconception that people don't have relationships across the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, even though you're in Washington only during that short work week. You do work together and you build friendships, but the problem is the outside influences of the political world just overshadow all of that.
I see. And you, in the book, you talk about those gerrymandered districts, cable news, yep. Big money. Are those the three big ones?
Well, there's others. A big problem in the country is the sorting of Americans based upon their interests, right? So you have this geographic enclave of Republicanism in one side of a community, and then all the Democrats will live together in the other side of the community. Mm-hmm. So you don't encounter people of other points of view, and you get a certainty that you're right, because everywhere you go, everybody agrees with you. That's actually a big problem. There's no solution to that, because that's just people choosing where to live.
Right. There's another book called The Big Sort. People
right.
are choosing to live in areas of the country where they're only around people that agree with them politically. And yes, so in your book, you talk about solutions. And by the way, we want your calls for Jason Altmaier. His new book, Dead Center, is in stores today. It's 549-2937. Can you read a little bit from your book?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I pulled up the part because of what has happened recently. This is actually the opening of my book. This is the introduction. On the morning of Sunday, June 12, 2016, Americans woke up to the horrific news that a deranged gunman had opened fire in a crowded Orlando nightclub, killing 49 people and wounding 68 others. Not long ago, such an attack would have had a unifying effect on the country, bringing together Americans of all backgrounds in a shared sense of grief. But not this time, at least not within the political world. The many unique facets of the shooting, the gay-friendly venue, the New York City-born Muslim shooter, the easily acquired arsenal of weapons, provided fodder for partisans looking for a reason to point fingers. Politicians and activists wasted no time in spinning the story for their political advantage. Democratic officials repeatedly referred to the mass shooting, while Republicans insisted it was a radical Islamic terrorism. Talking heads on cable news programs debated whether the problem had been caused by easy access to guns or a weak foreign policy. When it became apparent the victims had been targeted because of their sexual orientation, some Democrats criticized Republican officials for having the alleged hypocrisy to offer support to the LGBT community following the attack. And then later I continue along that and talk about some of the social media posts that occurred on both sides that were very unfortunately politically motivated. And then I say later in this same introduction, The tragedy also inspired a different, more positive side of America. While political activists blamed each other and positioned for political advantage, millions of everyday Americans rose to the occasion. These Americans came together not because of politics, but because they knew people were hurting, lives had been lost, a community had been shattered. Hundreds of people lined the streets in Central Florida waiting for hours to give blood. Thousands attended memorial vigils, not just in Orlando, but around the country. Millions of Americans, touched by the awful killing spree, did what they could to help. They donated money, sent notes of support, and organized relief effort. Relief funds would be established, combining to raise and distribute more than $40 million to Paul survivors and victims' families. For all the pessimism that pervades our polarized political process, this is the America that gives us hope. And I lead into that because that's an unfortunate circumstance in today's America, that anytime one of these tragedies happens, you have that response. You have that sort of polarized response. In most of America, they're normal folks. They want Congress to get along, to work together, to compromise.
Desperately do.
Right. That's America. So you wonder, how is it possible we have leadership in this country that is unwilling to do so, where you're actually punished for compromising in the political process? And that's what the book is about.
Is the obvious answer special moneyed interests?
Campaign finance is a big part of it. What I found, this is surprising. This was my first book, and again, it took me 2 years of research, and I have over 300 sources that I source in the book, and The Big Sword is one of them. And what you find is it actually changes your opinion on what the problems are. As someone who lost my seat in large part because of gerrymandering, I, of course, thought, well, that's got to be a huge problem. And what you find is all the things that we're talking about, those are symptoms. They're not the problem. The real problem is the polarization within our primary process. People who are in the center, moderates, they choose not to vote in primaries. So the only people who show up are on the political extremes, which means when you show up in November, your choices are between a Republican and a Democrat who represent the extremes of their party. So the solution has to be changing the primary process to take away that advantage that the extremes have.
Do you think we need open primaries?
Absolutely. I think that's the key to the whole thing. Campaign finance reform is a big part of it. You know, independent commissions for gerrymandering, civics education. I get into all these things, but the number one thing we could do would be to go to an open primary where everybody, regardless of party affiliation, votes in the same primary. Because if you do that and you're a candidate running for office, you have to appeal across that entire spectrum, not just appeal only to the far extreme of your political base.
Let's go to your calls now for the First Coast Zone. Jason Altmaier, the former Florida Blue executive and former member of Congress, is out with his new book this week. It's called Dead Center: How Political Polarization Divided America and What We Can Do About It. 549-2937. Jay is on the north side. Hi, Jay. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm usually Jay from Tampa, but I'm in town this week.
Okay.
And I hate to start off the conversation with as pointing a finger, but for decades, primarily from the right, there's been this shift in changing the narrative in education, fighting things like mentioning slavery during the Civil War, and changing our concept of what does freedom of speech mean. And I feel like because we are changing the way people are being educated about our democracy, we're now having a very different outcome in the way people are acting in our democracy. And I mean, we even fight simple ideas like evolution. And I guess I would like your guest's response or thought on how these changes in education are now having an effect in the way people are operating in our country.
Okay, thanks.
There's two parts. Thank you, Jay, for that question. There's two parts in my book that I go into great detail on the aspects of his question. One is on civics education. We have de-emphasized it because of the accountability and the testing standards not incorporating history and civics. And as a result, the Americans are woefully uninformed about our history, about the revolution, about, you know, I have an example where the American Revolution Center took a test, and the first question asking a survey of Americans was, do you think you could pass a 5-question test on the American Revolution? 89% of Americans said, well, yes, I could.
And they can't.
83% failed. More than half of Americans couldn't even place the American Revolution in the right century, for example. So woefully, I have a lot of examples like that in the book, woefully uneducated. We have to change that. We have to increase the level of civic awareness, which leads to civic involvement in voting and community involvement, but also political and voting. That has to change. He also talks about the lack of understanding and acceptance of scientific fact.
Right.
And I go into the book a lot, and this does affect both sides. You know, there are some large issues recently that the Republicans are on the wrong side of, for example, climate change with regard to science. But there are examples on both sides, which I talk about.
Where do you think the Democrats are ignoring science?
Well, it's not that they're ignoring. There have been studies done. There was a USC study in 2016. The results were published this year, where they tested both Democrats and Republicans on whether or not they would accept factual conclusions that went against their own political views.
Right.
And both sides were equally at fault of conveniently ignoring the facts that didn't coincide with their political views.
And one example that's come up recently, folks that are more progressive-leaning tend to be more skeptical of vaccines, for example.
That's the number one example.
Prominent example. Yeah. 549-2937. Susan in Mandarin. Hello, Susan.
Hi. How are you this morning, Melissa?
Good. Go ahead.
Yes. First of all, I really commend you for bringing this issue up of centrism. I think that you're absolutely correct. I myself am about 50 years old, and I've been a registered Democrat most of my life, and I've submitted congressional testimony, but I've worked even in preparing witnesses, senators, and representatives on both extremes, because I think you have to look at everything by issue, and unfortunately in our country, we're just becoming more and more polarized. And I think, yes, you're correct. The underlying issue is campaign finance. So where Congress is supposed to work for the people and bring back the sentiments of the people to Congress to then render their vote, they're really beholden to the people who finance their campaigns that allow them to get reelected. And that's the bottom line. The most gerrymandered district in the United States is Luis Gutierrez's. He's been trying to pass the DREAM Act since 2001, and he's been unsuccessful. He's a Democrat. He should step down because he's an ineffective congressman. Now, I have a question for you. I know that, you know, what your stance has been on the gun laws in Florida. With what happened on Sunday, I had published this, and I had a direct response from the director of Cato Institute, really coming after me very aggressively over a year ago when I predicted that exactly what happened on Sunday would happen as a result of the bump stock modification on ARs. The NRA, who has tremendous influence in Congress because of campaign finance, they got that through Congress and through, I guess, ATF, or however the regulations go, by saying that they needed to be able to modify, you know, single-shot semi-automatic rifles and basically render them into fully automatic rifles like what we saw in Vegas because of, for example, handicapped veterans who may be partially paralyzed or too weak to shoot an assault rifle. And under those pretenses, that's how the slide fire or the bump stocks came to be allowed. And there's no reason any hunter, any firearms trainer such as myself, any target shooter or for home protection, there's no viable reason to allow that kind of a modification to an AR for a non-military civilian. So I think that's a perfect example of where the partisanship fails the safety of United States citizens.
All right, Susan, thanks for that. As a former Democratic member of Congress, certainly gun control can be predicted to be a litmus test for Democratic presidential candidates now in 2020. This is going to be, I would guess, a defining issue for them in the next cycle, not for Republicans, though. This is a divisive wedge issue.
It is inconceivable, impossible to imagine that the Democratic nominee for president in 2020 would not have a very Democratic, far-left view on the gun control issue. It has become such a focal point of the debate that on the Democratic side, you couldn't possibly hope to get the nomination if you weren't good on that issue.
Now, but on the Republican side, a very different narrative. And there seems to be no common ground, which is what you're calling for.
Well, the caller, let me say what my perspective. The district I represented in western Pennsylvania bordered the Ohio and West Virginia borders. And if you put a dot on my district and did a 100-mile radius around it, I had more NRA members per capita in my congressional district that I represented than any other district in the country.
Are you a gun owner?
I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not. So I understand, right? I heard the arguments on both sides on this issue. And the caller made the point that the NRA is powerful because of campaign finance and sort of saying political donations. That is not why the NRA is powerful. The NRA is powerful because they have millions of Americans that believe in their mission of protecting the Second Amendment. Now, I do think in the country, when you see these repeated attacks, huge scale mass casualty shootings, that nowhere else in the world has the same level of attacks that we do, you have to ask the question, why does this only happen here? What are we doing differently that everybody else in the world is not doing? It will happen as an anomaly occasionally somewhere else.
But not with such regularity.
No, not all the time, unfortunately, which it happens here. So I do think regardless of where you are on the Second Amendment, you have to just out of common sense for the system and what's happening in this country, you have to ask, what are we doing differently and what could we change to make it better?
Here's a comment for you on our Facebook page from Paula. What would it take to get some sensible reforms, gun reforms, through Congress that 90% of Americans favor? As you were saying earlier, Jason, the majority of Americans are in the sensible center, but that's not reflected in our leadership.
I was in Congress during the Virginia Tech shooting, and after the Virginia Tech shooting, which you'll remember, there was a man walked around campus, walked into classrooms, just horrific, killed, I believe, 32 people. That was a time when Congress came together afterwards and passed some gun legislation. It wasn't that nothing happened. They passed some mental health screening, background checks, things like that. So I think after events like this, you will see a move towards, the caller talked about the automatic weapons and things like that and being able to reconfigure weapons. I think there's going to be a look at that. But as far as outright banning of guns, I just don't think that politically that's going to happen anytime soon. But you have to ask the question, what could we do? What's realistic in the current political environment? What can we do to prevent this from happening ever again?
Some tweets for you and emails from Rob. I'm a registered independent. I try to see both sides of an issue. How do we deal with gerrymandering and fake news stories inserted by enemy nations? He's talking about Russia, designed to further divide us. Things are getting bad in our country. Here are some tweets from Lisa. How much responsibility does the partisan press bear for dividing the country? What can be done about it? From Jim, your guest identifies as a moderate Democrat. Why isn't he a moderate Republican? In your book, Dead Center, you identify what you see as potential solutions to the polarization that's ripping this country apart. What about all of those questions for you?
Well, there's a lot to work with, and I do touch on all of those questions in my book in great detail. On gerrymandering, it's simple. You have to take the decision-making out of the politicians who have a stake in how those districts are drawn. Instead of letting the voters decide who their elected officials are going to be, we've done the opposite. We've let our elected officials choose their voters and solidify their seats. So you have to go to independent commissions. California has done it to great success. Arizona has done it. The Supreme Court today has a major case that they're hearing on this very issue. And if they rule that partisan gerrymandering is a thing of the past, then we would go to independent commissions to draw those lines. It would make a very big difference. Mm-hmm. With regard to solutions that we could move forward to, again, looking towards the future, you get into civics education, but things that we could do to change right now, unfortunately, with campaign money, the Supreme Court has determined that money equals free speech.
Citizens United.
Yes. So we are unlikely to see any type of political remedy to just...
Unless we get a different Supreme Court at some point.
Right, which is a very long-term process. The Congress could theoretically change the rules on disclosure, because right now you don't even know who sponsors these ads that you see. They'll just have a name like Americans for Prosperity, and you don't know, well, who are their donors? Where do they come from? So that's tinkering around the edges. But research has shown, I talk about this, this is interesting, that members of Congress, when you look at their voting record, it coincides much more closely to the people who give them money than the views of their constituency. And that may not be surprising, but when you see the research that shows that, it really makes you think, well, who is being represented? Is it the people who are living their lives in everyday America thinking, who are the Jaguars playing on Sunday? What activity does my kid have tonight? What's my schedule look like for the work week? That's normal folks. Are they being represented, or are the people who are contributing money to the elected officials being represented? Well, studies have shown that the voting record aligns a lot more closely to their political donors than their constituents.
You have a book signing tonight. Can you let everybody know where they can come out and meet you?
I am at Epping Forest from 5:30 to 7:30, and it's a book launch party. Today is actually the day the book comes out, so anyone can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you prefer to buy your books. But I live here in Ponte Vedra, so we're going to kick it off in Jacksonville. I'm going to Pittsburgh on Thursday. I have a big event in Washington next week, but the opening event is tonight at Epping Forest.
At what time?
5:30 to 7:30.
5:30 tonight at Epping Forest. Come on out and meet former member of Congress and now author Jason Altmaier. The book, Dead Center, How Political Polarization Divided America and What We Can Do About It. Jason, a pleasure as always. Thanks so much for kicking off your book tour with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead later, how Players by the Sea is recovering from Hurricane Irma and how you can support them. Also, our tribute to Florida's own rock legend Tom Petty. But up next, as we kick off Breast Cancer Awareness Month, it's the 10th anniversary of the Pink Ribbon Symposium on the First Coast. We'll tell you about it. Back in a moment.
Join WJCT and Special Forces Association Chapter 88 for a special fundraising reception before the Vietnam War and Stories of Service. The reception supports the SFA Chapter 88 and begins at 6 p.m. on October 3rd. For more information and to purchase your $20 ticket, visit wjct.org/storiesofservice.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. I grew up in West Palm Beach, just down I-95 from Jacksonville, and it always amazed me how many different kinds of people that highway connects. Now I get to connect with people from all walks of life here on WJCT, debating tough topics with courage, clarity, and compassion. Join us for 1A, weekday mornings at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
This week on Jazz Night in America, our point of view. a leaderless supergroup of Blue Note artists.
Our point of view is our story, our influence, our life, and our music.
Robert Glasper, Derek Hodge, Kendrick Scott, Lionel Luweke, Ambrose Akinmusiri, and Marcus Strickland. Discover our point of view this week on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. The Pink Ribbon Symposium is celebrating its 10-year anniversary this weekend. October marks Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and the theme of this year's conference is the importance of knowing your body. Here with a preview, we welcome family medicine hospitalist Dr. Takiyah Jones. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, this is the 10-year anniversary of Pink Ribbon Symposium. Jeannie Blaylock of First Coast News is the guest speaker. And, of course, she's the founder of Buddy Check 12, encouraging women to get mammograms every month. It's so important to do that. And so this is a reminder, among other things.
Absolutely. And we're also happy to celebrate Jeannie's 25th year anniversary for Buddy Check 12. And she's also our inaugural speaker for the Pink Ribbon Symposium. So it's all coming together full circle.
Now, this has been going on for 10 years, and there's so much that women can learn when they come out to the symposium. Tell us a little bit about what's going to be happening.
So not only do we have a focus on breast cancer in terms of diagnosis and prevention, we also have topics that include issues of survivorship. And we've expanded the symposium even further to talk about other issues such as caring for our bodies. Breast cancer and rehab programs are available locally, so we wanted to talk about that. Survivors often have questions about hormone therapy, whether or not it's safe. And now we know more about genetic testing and family risk, so we want to be able to answer those questions.
And what can we learn about individualized testing and whether you can calibrate safety for each woman and how that differs from patient to patient?
So basically, individualized testing really has to be discussed with your primary care doctor. We know that if there's a family history of breast cancer, you can have as much as a 15% increased risk. So that's something that we want to discuss. But also, you know, some patients may be recommended to have genetic testing. And, you know, positive BRCA tests may indicate up to 50% lifetime risk of breast cancer.
My mother passed away from breast cancer, so I underwent the BCRA or BRCA test. Mm-hmm. It came back negative for me, which was really good news. But I just got a letter in the mail recommending an MRI in addition to a mammogram. So there's a lot of ways now that physicians encourage women to monitor their risk and get tested.
Absolutely. And those are some of the things that we're going to talk about at the symposium.
And you encourage women to bring their spouses. There's even a man cave at this thing.
Yes, I am so excited about this event. We want men to be involved, too, because it's not just women that are affected by breast cancer. It's the entire family. But we wanted to kind of have that carrot, if you will, to entice men to come. So there is a man cave. It is exclusively for men. And you can meet the docs and basically interact with them and ask individual questions. And we have a Corvette show. So this is going to be so exciting. It really is for everyone.
Nice. You've also got a pretty in pink pampering room for manicures and massages, chair yoga, tai chi, live entertainment from the Jacksonville Harmony Chorus and Orange Park High School Band. AARP is on hand with a special presentation. Outdoor vendor marketplace, lots of fun going on at the 10-year anniversary of the Pink Ribbon Symposium. Now, this is at the Moosehaven Retirement Community coming up October 7th. How can people find you and tell everybody how they can get their tickets and how they can be part of this?
So we're asking, if you will, to please register online. You can go to eventbrite.com. You can do a simple search and type in Pink Ribbon Symposium and register. But if you're on you're still welcome to come and just register on site. You can also go to our website, which is pinkribbonsymposium.org, and we're on Facebook.
Thank you so much for being here. It is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. It's already here. Can you believe
yes.
it?
Thank you.
She's Dr. Takiyah Jones. It's this weekend's Pink Ribbon Symposium, the 10th anniversary. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Join WJCT and Special Forces Association Chapter 88 for an evening watching, listening to, and discussing the many stories of service from the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War and Stories of Service is October 3rd at 7 p.m. at WJCT Studios. For more information and to RSVP for this free event, visit wjct.org/storiesofservice. WJCT's Jaguar Season Parking is still available. Be part of the coolest tailgating downtown. Includes paved space, indoor bathroom access. Contact Holly Manuel at 358-6311 or log on to wjct.org/parking. Reserve your space today.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. It is the new publication here in Northeast Florida that celebrates our local food culture. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining and hospitality trends around the First Coast, Lee Cord of the Women's Food Alliance speaks with Lauren Titus, editor of Edible Magazine.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to Gravy Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too.
What does an editor of a culinary magazine think about when you get up in the morning? What are you working on? How do you create such a magical publication?
Well, I'm very fortunate in Northeast Florida right now because the food community is booming. Since we started the magazine about two and a half years ago, we've been constantly filling our pages with story ideas. There's no lack of interesting people and restaurants and farms and artisans working in the food community right now. So my job, which I'm so excited and proud to have, is to help gather those stories, connect the fabulous writers and photographers in the area, and hook them up with the folks that are making our food community so vibrant right now. So each of our issues has a theme, starting from our very first, which the theme was the beginning. And we talked about where food comes from and all aspects of what it means to eat local. And from there, we've devised themes. Part of my job is to come up with the themes, which I just did for the year 2018. And then all of the stories align to the themes as we, you know, as we think about the time of year that the theme is going to appear in. We think about what's in season. So I'll connect with chefs or home cooks who may be doing interesting things with the seasonal ingredients. Look at the different restaurants and what might be opening. So that's my typical day, is to think about what my next theme is and who I need to connect with to tell their story. And the publisher and the editor of each issue, each version, has complete liberty to cover all the hyperlocal stories in an area.
That's so important. When you say hyperlocal, you really dig right into the heart of North Florida.
Right.
Who is your publisher?
Amy Robb, who is based out of St. Augustine, as I am. And she wanted to help showcase the fabulous stories in Northeast Florida. So she, about 2.5 years ago, bought the license, and she was on her way home from a national edible communities meeting and texted me and said she knew that I was looking to do something different after my corporate job, and texted me and said, "Lauren, have you made your leap, and would you like to write about food?" And I said, "Yes, oh, and absolutely yes." And about 3 days later, we met, and that's when we started. We hit the ground running in March of 2015, and we haven't stopped yet.
I am sure your readers cherish every issue and keep them front and center because they're so timely. You know, it's not something that goes out of style 6 months from now. You know, the content is great. What are some of the themes that you have enlivened over the past 2 years, and what are some of the upcoming?
Well, we have done, one of my favorites was the citrus issue, January, February of this year, which helped to showcase the history of citrus in Northeast Florida. You know, places like Mandarin, Satsuma, those are local towns that were named as a result of this being a thriving citrus industry. We did an international issue, which helped showcase the amazingly diverse community that we have, from Indian to Asian to Pakistani, Ethiopian, all different types of restaurants and markets in the area. We did a lunch issue. Everyone talks about what's for dinner, but it was fun.
I loved your lunch issue.
It was fun talking about what's for lunch.
Yes.
And our most recent issue is the heat issue, which seemed very appropriate for the summertime.
It's just amazing that food isn't just a meal anymore. Food is a lifestyle. So I am so glad that you're loving what you're doing. Don't make a change. Just stay with edible. Keep us all informed. And one little secret. I need a hint from you. What is one of your favorite foods of North Florida?
Oh, my.
I hate to put you on the spot, but you write about food. You're right in the heartbeat of what's going on in our breakfast, lunches, and dinners, and late night, and chefs. Tell me, what is one of your favorite foods, Lauren?
I don't think I could claim a favorite. I just have had a great opportunity to taste a lot of different food and drink throughout the area, and I can't think of anything I haven't liked yet.
Are you going to do an ice cream issue? Somehow in the dead of summer, I think about ice cream every day.
Well, we actually partnered with the Hippo Popsicle Company, and they created an ice cream sandwich for us for our heat issue, and it was a dattle ginger peach ice cream.
Wait, stop. Dattle
ginger
peach ice cream.
So it was
yes.
a little hot and cold, and it was sandwiched between a chocolate cayenne cookie.
Oh, gosh, my.
And it was pretty amazing.
I hate to say goodbye, but thank you for joining us from Edible Magazine, Lauren Titus. I am running off to Hippo to get one of those ice cream specialty hot things to cool off the day.
Thank you very much, Lee.
Thanks. It's been great to have you here.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
Well, rock legend Tom Petty died last night. The Gainesville, Florida native was 66. Petty went into cardiac arrest at his Malibu home and was taken to UCLA Medical Center, where he clung to life but ultimately couldn't be revived. His career as lead singer with the Heartbreakers spanned the decades with a string of generation-defining hits that landed the group in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers just performed at the Hollywood Bowl only last week, showing how relevant and beloved they remained right up until the end. I truly loved Tom Petty. In fact, I burst into tears yesterday when I heard he'd passed. His music literally formed the soundtrack to my life, the lives of an entire generation.
Yes, he was a classic rock staple, but Petty was something more. He was a poet, a child of poverty, and you might not know it, but also extreme abuse. You could sense that mournful quality and that vulnerability in him. You loved him for it, for overcoming those terrible circumstances, even if you didn't quite know why. You loved him for his talent and for the way his music made you feel. Music, said Tom Petty, is the only real magic that I know. You know, Petty's songs, they were part of the American car culture. They're meant to be listened to in your car, out on the road, on the radio, the old-fashioned way, on full blast, singing along at the top of your lungs. So go ahead, American girls and boys out there. Turn it up all the way. Pump the gas and shed a tear for Tom Petty. Well, finally, this hour, they've brought world-class theater to the beaches for more than 50 years. This Saturday, Players by the Sea will celebrate its volunteers, performers, and donors. It's their end-of-the-season event, The Curtain Call, featuring a special performance of Smokey Joe's Cafe. Here with the preview production manager, Jeremy Rakett, and creative marketing manager, Bradley Akers. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hi. Good morning.
Now, we need to mention you guys suffered some damage from Irma, correct?
Yes, we did. The show goes on.
The show must go on. So you're going on despite a little flooding damage.
Yeah, we had some, you know, great efforts. The staff, you know, pitched in to get us back together, get the building back together. And we also had to push the current show that we had back as well. But, you know, we're up and running and everything's great.
Okay, so The Curtain Call will include songs from the production. And what else can we expect?
The event will include great food from Taste, select wines and beer products from Royal Palms Village and Wine and Tapas. And then Heineken is also a sponsor for the event. Then we have a delicious dessert bar sponsored by Liberty Bakery, along with live entertainment, great experiences, and products from our local donors.
Sounds pretty fun.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you're also honoring some special people that make Players by the Sea such a great experience at the beaches.
Absolutely. You know, what we do at the theater, we couldn't do any of that without the help of our volunteers and the stage, you know, both on the stage and behind the scenes. So there's actors and actresses that, you know, we're honoring as well as our some donors. You know, one is Mahelda Arnold, who's done so much for the theater. Lauren Hancock, who is our young actress. Her mother is a costumer, and so she's jumped in a lot of times for us. And so we just, those are just a couple of, I think, the six we have that we're honoring that evening.
Yeah. Okay. And Bradley Akers, the whole evening is to benefit theater programming, including scholarships that attend your performing arts studio. Can you tell us about the children's theater programs at Players by the Sea?
Sure, yes. Well, it's we believe that arts education and theater education do so much more than kids getting up on stage and saying lines. It's teaching communication and responsibility and time management and how to work as a team. So we do have year-long youth performances, classes, summer camps. We do outreach programs. I mean, we've also introduced classes for guitar and piano recently to try to broaden the experience. And every year we go to a competition to and we don't really call it compete, even though it's a competition, but to really work with a whole bunch of studios and theater programs. And our education director just brought back Best Director from last year's competition, so that was really exciting.
And in addition to working with the kids, you've also gone out to do community outreach with groups that want to do team building. How does that work?
Right. Well, we look at it as approaching a way to develop a program for a school or a community center. And it all started with our original education director, Barbara Colicello. And it has continued through the education directors and now Jocelyn Geronimo. We've worked with the North Florida School of Special Education, Mayport Naval Station, Pablo Towers, the Noble School, just a bunch of really great, deserving centers.
Okay, so it sounds like a great night, and it definitely benefits an important cause. So come on out to Curtain Call, featuring a special performance of Smokey Joe's Cafe at Players by the Sea Saturday night. Tickets are $65. Tickets at the door or online at playersbythesea.org. Guys, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great show. Break a leg.
Thank you.
That is our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Make sure to get our podcast on iTunes or through our app. And next on 1A, after the deadliest mass shooting in recent U.S. history, how are you doing? I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.